Hey, comic book fans, this is Donald F. Glute, a.k.a. Don Glute and Dinosaur Don, writer of some of your favorite comic book, live-action, and animated superhero stories. And you're listening to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life.
Hey there, funny book fans. Welcome to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. I'm your host, Joe Stuber. Just kicking back here in the lair with a super-sized bowl of Cap'n Crunch cereal. Well, you know what that means. It's time to fire up the Wayback Machine and talk about Saturday morning TV shows from back in the day. Yes, it is. Today, we're going to revisit some of those series with the talented man who wrote a bunch of the stories that we've loved over the years. Writer, producer, director Donald F. Glute. He's going to be along in just a few minutes. We're going to cover a lot of ground today, so you are in store for an amazing episode of Comic Book Central. Looking forward to this one. Hey, before I chat with Donald, I wanted to give a shout out to some folks who work for a very cool publication right here in Columbus, Ohio, where I'm broadcasting from the Comic Book Central there, the heart of the Buckeye State, Columbus, Ohio. The magazine is called Columbus Alive. And two very cool cats from the magazine stopped by the lair for a little behind-the-scenes feature on Comic Book Central. Journalist Erica Thompson and photographer Rob Harden, they were here, they were hanging out, they were nerding out, talking about geek culture. We had a blast. Really nice feature article in the magazine. You can read the article online at columbusalive.com. I also posted a link to it on the Comic Book Central Facebook page at facebook.com/comicbookcentralnetwork. Also on Twitter at ComicBookCTRL, so those links are there. If you're in the Columbus area, be sure to pick up a copy. You can find out where to get a copy on the website. Again, ColumbusAlive.com. I'll also put a link to the article in the show notes for this episode at my website, so a bunch of different ways you can get to it. It's a fun read. It was fun. I had a fun time hanging out. My thanks to Eric and Rob and the folks at Columbus Alive. Thanks so much for doing that. Be sure to check it out. Hey, you're going to get a behind-the-scenes peek right here in the Comic Book Central lair. It's pretty cool. All right, you can read that article later. Right now, I want you to take a listen to this. It's a little bit of background on my special guest today. Then I'm going to be right back to talk fan films, comic books, Saturday morning television, so much more with Donald F. Glute. Now, these days, fan films are about as common as, well, podcasts, to be honest. But back in the 1950s, no one knew what a fan film was. And thus begins our story of a young Don Glute, who, as a kid, knew he wanted to make his own versions of those incredible adventures that he was seeing on the silver screen. From the early 1950s all the way through his time at USC Film School, Donald wrote, produced, and directed over 40 short films featuring dinosaurs, monsters, and comic book characters like Captain Marvel, Superman, Captain America, Batman, and Spider-Man. He even put himself in the lead in some of those pretty cool comic book characters. But in 1974, Donald got his big break in showbiz when he was brought in to write an official adventure of Captain Marvel for the Saturday morning superhero series Shazam.
That's an emergency call. Shazam!
That gig led to more Saturday morning work on shows like the dino-centric Land of the Lost and animated shows including Dinomutt, The Flintstones, and Space Sentinels. But Donald got to spin some of his best TV tales when he was brought on as a writer for both Spider-Man animated series that debuted on the same day, September 12, 1981, the syndicated Spider-Man and NBC's Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends.
Spider-Man and his amazing friends, Iceman and Firestar.
Filmmaker, musician, author, dinosaur enthusiast, Donald has done a lot over his long career. And with published works from Charlton, DC, Gold Key, Marvel, and Archie Comics, he's got some major league comic book cred as well. I want to welcome to the show now a writer, director, producer who has been bringing us tales of our favorite comic book characters for some time now. A big Comic Book Central welcome to Donald F. Glue. Donald, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for being here.
Thank you for pronouncing my last name correctly.
Do you often get some variations of that, or?
Well, you know, a lot of people. I was interviewed last night by someone on the air, and they introduced me as Don Glut, so you know, which I've gotten ever since I was a kid, and so I thought by now people would know how to pronounce it, but I guess
I can call you Don Glut if you want. I'll call you whatever you want. That's well, we talked even off mic. You know, sometimes it's Donald F. Sometimes it's Don. You know, depending. So I'll call you whatever you want to be called.
Oh, Don is fine.
Look, as what we're going to discuss today, we've got a lot of topics to talk about today. Mm-hmm. But one thing I know about you, you are a huge fan of monsters, creatures, dinosaurs. You're an expert on dinosaurs, right?
Yeah, well, I'm an amateur expert, let's put it that way. I'm not a professional paleontologist, but I've written quite a few very serious, you know, semi-technical books. And I worked at the Natural History Museum one day as a volunteer fossil preparer up at the dinosaur lab. So, you know, it's a very big part of my life.
So you got some cred. You got some dino cred. You got some monster, some creature cred here. I got to ask you, and listeners are wondering, what have you seen the latest Kong movie, Skull Island?
No, I haven't yet.
I'm surprised to hear that. Okay, I thought that would be like right up your alley.
Well, I usually get invited to screenings and things, so I just kind of wait until that happens. Movies are so expensive now, and I'd rather put that money into something a little bit more lasting than 2 hours sitting in a movie theater. You know, and so you might want to call me frugal. You might want to call me cheap. But if I wait long enough, I get to see a screen.
Okay, I'm just surprised. I look at all like this body of work you've done, and there's just like all these creatures. I mean, you know, even some of the projects you've worked on with Bob Burns, and we know Bob Burns is famous for having all these, you know, creature props and things like that. Okay, so I was curious about that.
I haven't seen the new Star Wars yet, and I haven't seen Doctor Strange yet. So
wow, you really don't go to the movies, do you?
No, it takes me a while to catch up. You know, going to the movies was a pleasurable experience, but you know, I hate. First of all, they're way too expensive. No matter how spectacular the movie is, they're way too expensive, and you know, I don't want to sit there for 45 minutes of trailers and commercials and things before we even get to the movie. And people on cell phones, and, you know, it's not like it used to be.
Well, it's like, because I know a lot of these creatures and things that you love, they're coming back now. So is it, where do you kind of sit on this as far as, you know, is it your fanboy love of the creatures, you just love seeing them in these new, different presentations, or is it just all too CGI, you know, video gamey looking for you, and you just prefer the classics?
Well, I'll tell you, and this is going to shock a lot of people, I am really getting sick of CGI. All those movies looked the same to me. I saw the trailers for Kong on television, you know, and it looked like every other CGI movie I've ever seen. I mean, they all look the same to me. Where in the old days, everything looked different. I watched Bambi the other night for the first time in many years. And the animation in that was so, and storytelling was so great. And, you know, now every animation movie looks alike. They all look, all those Pixar films and everything, they're like cookie cutters. They're, you know, the quick cuts, the celebrity voices, the one-liners, they're all the same. And so I guess I'm a traditionalist, and I do like the old classic movies. I like the practical effects where characters are played by real actors, and not turning into CGI cartoons, you know, as soon as they put the mask on. I guess I'm old-fashioned in many ways.
Well, and I think we've seen, there's not to any great degree, but I've certainly seen maybe a leaning toward that again. Because I know you mentioned, you know, the last Star Wars film, not Rogue One, but The Force Awakens, directed by J.J. Abrams. I noticed even in that, Because that was the thing that drove me nuts about the prequels, that it was just all CGI, and it just all looked like a video game. I noticed this one, he's like going out into the desert. He's got an actual robot that works, and he's using some practical creatures, which does, it just gives it that depth and that dirty, gritty, lived-in look. So hopefully we're seeing maybe a drifting back to that.
Yeah, well, you remember when we were a kid, of course I go back a lot farther than you do, but when you would sit in the movie theater, and you would be watching some crappy science fiction movie with some El Cheapo special effects, and you would sit there and wonder, gee, how did they do that? Nobody says it anymore because you know how they did it. It's some guy sitting behind a keyboard, you know, tapping away, because they're all done the same way. So we've lost that sense of wonder on how some of these films were made. Right now, we just finished shooting a Frankenstein movie, which has a lot of monsters and things in it, a lot of different kinds of creatures and characters, but it's practical effects. It's real actors with makeups, you know. Mm-hmm. It was a great, wonderful experience for me because, like you said, you know, I love those old movies, the old fanboy thing kicking in, and actually getting to do one of those was a real thrill for me.
I think there's a way to probably combine the best of both worlds. I tell you, the one thing I've seen that I really love that I haven't seen it done much since, there's a movie called The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen based on the graphic novel. It didn't do well. I know Connery kind of, you know, he didn't like it. But there's a character in that, Hyde, where they mixed the CG with the prosthetics and the actor. And it's, I you know, the only way I can describe it to people is it just looks really, really good. And that was a while back.
Well, to me, that character, you know, I guess I'll disagree with you. I thought that character looked like a cartoon. It's just like it was stuck in there.
I'm an easier audience.
Well, I'm going to lose a lot of audience, probably, what we talk about today. You know, but, you know, because a lot of the things I've done, a lot of the things I do, it's not because I'm a fan. It's because I'm earning a living. I'm making, you know, I'm paying the rent and all that sort of thing. And a lot of people think that just because, you know, I wrote Transformer cartoons, that I'm a Transformers fan, and I'm not a Transformers fan. You know, a lot of the stuff was just a job, and a lot of people can't understand that, especially when something I did touched their lives or something when they were a kid. Mm-hmm. And to me, a lot of the stuff I don't even remember because it was just kind of cranked out, you know, to make a house payment or something, or pay an electric bill.
No, I think we get into that when we talk to actors, writers, and producers about a lot of these projects. What I do like about, and when you look back, and we'll talk about your career here, is the fact that you are a fanboy. You are a comic book kid. You do love all these things. And I think that weaves its way in, depending on the project, maybe, you know, your background with it. But I think we see that in a lot of your work. Where did the interest in comic books and the love for superheroes and action, adventure, and all this start? Do you recall the earliest interest in that?
Yeah, well, when I was a little kid, I mean, you know, like 4 years old or something, I remember, you know, my mother and people would buy me comic books. Or I remember following Superman mostly in the newspaper. So my knowledge of Superman was based on the newspaper strip and the radio show. But, you know, so most of the comic books that were bought were Dell Comics, you know, the Walt Disneys and Tarzan and you know, that kind of thing. So I was exposed and loved comic books as a little kid, and I loved Superman. I always loved Superman as a kid, mainly, again, because of the radio show and the newspaper strip. And then I kind of got out of it. I grew out of it, you know, when I was a teenager. I got into rock and roll and playing in bands and all that sort of thing and getting interested in girls. And then when I was in high school, and to me, all the superheroes at that time were pretty much the ones that still existed in comics. This is the early 1950s to middle 1950s. You know, were basically Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman, and the ones that were in the back of the book, like Green Arrow and Aquaman. So there weren't a whole lot of superheroes around that time. I remember I was fond of the Blue Beetle, which was being reprinted and revived by Charlton in those days. But then what happened was, in high school, I got scarlet fever. And I was confined. I couldn't go to school. I was, you know, I spent a month at home in bed. And my mother went to the newsstand, not to the local candy shop, that confectionery shop that used to sell comic books. And she bought one of those, I guess it was Brave and Bold, Green Lantern tryout issues. And I'd never seen a character like that before. First of all, he wasn't an imitation of Superman, didn't wear a cape. He had a mask without a string on it. When he flew, it looked like he was just sort of suspended in the air. And to me, that was so intriguing, a brand new type of superhero. And then I saw the ads for the first Justice League story. And those kind of things, those two things brought me back into the superhero thing. Because before that, my only interest in comics during my rock and roll days and everything, my early rock and roll days, was the horror stuff. I loved the pre-code horror comics. And I used to spend hours and hours seeking out old bookstores where you could buy the pre-code horror books for like a nickel a piece. Mm-hmm. And so it was really Green Lantern that brought me back. And then, of course, the Marvel thing was down the road. But to me, when I saw that Justice League ad and all those characters together in one page, on one panel, that was very alluring to me, especially seeing characters that were obscure, like the Martian Manhunter and Aquaman. Those are characters we never even talked about when I was a kid. But there they were, and that kind of brought me back. And then I got sucked into that whole Marvel thing, and I became a fan again.
Okay, growing up, you eventually then decided to go to USC Film School?
I went to USC Film School. Yeah, I originally enrolled in DePaul University in Chicago. And at that time, I had no idea what I wanted to do. All I knew was one thing. I didn't want to work in a regular job. And we had a thing called College Day at my high school, which is where you sat in an auditorium all day long, and people from different universities and colleges came in, and they sort of, did commercials for their school. Well, our school is the best for engineering, yada, yada, yada.
Yeah, they need to recruit people. Yeah, they're trying to recruit
people. Yeah, and they were recruiting people, and I was sitting next to a friend of mine, and I was thinking, I don't want to do any of this stuff. I don't want to be an engineer or going to, marketing. None of this stuff interests me at all. And then he nudged me, and he said, he was just joking. He said, well, I think I'll go to UCLA, which was like, that was something you never even thought about, going to UCLA or Yale or Harvard or any of these things. And then what happened was, this was in senior year, my mother said, what would you like for a graduation present? And I said, what I would like for a high school graduation present is I'd like a trip to California, because at the time I was corresponding with Bob Burns and Ron Haydock and Forry Ackerman, these legendary characters who were putting out monster magazines. And they knew I was making amateur movies as a hobby. I was making monster movies and superhero movies and things. And I don't know if I was making superhero movies yet. It was still the monster movies. Anyway, Forry Ackerman sent me a spatial delivery letter. It came special D, saying that if you come out to California, bring your movies. I'd like to see some of them. So, okay, we had this vacation, and I put all these movies in a suitcase. These were 16-millimeter movies in heavy film cans, so I had them in a suitcase. Was almost on the breaking point. They were that heavy. But I brought them with me, took a train out to Los Angeles, and Ackerman, when I called him, he said, I might be able to arrange to have Burt I. Gordon, the director, who was making things like The Amazing Colossal Man and The Attack of the Puppet People and The Magic Sword, come over to watch your movies. I said, wow, I'm going to get to meet an actual film director, Hollywood movie producer. And you got to remember that making amateur films at that time was my main hobby, my main passion.
Yeah, that's what that's what I was interested in, because this was... You started all that while you were in high school?
Grammar school, 9 years old is when
I
started.
Okay, so you're starting like with the monster stuff. So you're basically making these 16-millimeter films. You knew even at that point, even at that young of an age, that you wanted to do something with film, or was it just specifically
a
hobby? Like not even a vocation at that point?
Because in those days in Chicago, now I have a lot of friends in Chicago who are very talented writers, artists, actors, musicians, but none of them seem to get the idea you could do that as your day job. They look at it, like you say, as a hobby. So anyway, that was my hobby when I went out to California. And when I got to Ackerman's house that day, two important things that were life-changing incidents happened for me. One was that Burt Gordon, the director, when he watched my movies, it was nothing but compliments. And there was actually a scene I did. He didn't know how a special effects scene that he didn't know how I did, and I had to explain to him how I did it. And he could have said, you know, oh, these are nice. Go get a job in your uncle's shoe store or something. But he didn't. He was very encouraging. But the other thing, Forey Ackerman did not have a movie projector. And there was a young guy there named Ray Craig, who is still a good friend of mine. Ray Craig brought the movie projector. So I was talking to Ray. Ray was about 4 years older than I was. So we had something in common, the age thing, you know. And I said, is that your projector? It was a nice Bell & Howell projector. And he said, no, I borrowed this from USC Film School. I said, you borrowed this from what? From where? There's a school that you can go to, a college, a university, to learn how to make movies, and your homework is making movies? He said, yeah. So he took me down to the campus, and he showed me all around the campus, the cinema department. And I went back to the hotel, and I told my mother, I said, I don't know what it's going to take. I don't care what happens. I don't care what it's going to take, but I am going to go to USC Film School. And what happened was then I went back to Chicago. I went 2 years to DePaul and got most of my requirements out of the way. And then I applied to USC, and they accepted me. And I moved out to California. And suddenly, it wasn't just me, the only kid on the block making films with nobody else interested in it. It was everybody I knew was either in the business or making films, or, you know, it was all my friends suddenly were doing the same kind of thing I was doing, and I just never left. Except, go to visits and things.
Do you recall what scene that was that mystified everybody in your movie?
Oh, yeah. I made an amateur version of King Kong, and it was a guy running across a field and climbing a tree as a dinosaur chased him. And the dinosaur was stop motion, and the guy was real. And I put the camera up on a tripod, and the dinosaur was on a picnic table, which is in the foreground. And I used, there's a technique called, force perspective, where you're shooting with a wide-angle lens, and you have enough light, you can get something in the foreground and in the background, both in focus, okay? So I had the guy, the human actor, way in the background, and I had the camera locked down on a tripod, and the guy runs across the field looking very small, and then hiding behind a tree, and then I did a stop-motion dinosaur up in front of the camera, a frame at a time, and brought him across, and the effect, I won't say it was seamless, but the effect was very amazing, the way it turned out, and it looks like the guy is running, pursued by this dinosaur.
Enough to get their attention, that's for sure.
Yeah, and then I cut to a close-up of him, and then I did a kind of a front projection that we got, we went down to my basement, and I set up my screen, and I projected on the screen the head of the dinosaur attacking, and he was in front, like holding onto the tree in front of the screen, and I re-photographed the whole thing, so you know, that's what we did following the shot that amazed everybody. But, I wonder if Forey had had his own projector, or if Burt Gordon had not shown up, or if Burt Gordon had been dismissive of the whole thing, I may have been shattered. I may not have gotten the idea to go to film school. My whole career would have been different. You know, I might be working in a grocery store or something today, you know, and being unhappy.
Or an engineer like they wanted you to go to college for.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's really funny how these things happen.
Wow, all everything came together.
So much of my life has been just strange coincidences that happened. The only reason I started making movies when I was 9 years old, my dad was in the Baker's Union. He was a baker before he went in the Army. And some friend of his, owed him some money. And he couldn't pay the money, so he gave him something he owned, which was a 16-millimeter movie camera. And so my mother then, as a Christmas present or a birthday present to my dad, bought him a projector. So suddenly we had a projector and a camera in our family, and it was mostly for showing, you know, family movies and, you know, birthdays and that sort of thing. And then, you know, we had some cartoons and things you could buy back then in those days before videotape and DVDs. So we always had this movie camera and projector and a screen in the family. And then I saw this, I was just getting into dinosaurs, and I saw this movie called The Beast in 20,000 Fathoms when it first came out. And I wanted to be able to show that movie in my house anytime I wanted to. And in those days, you couldn't buy, like I said, you couldn't buy VHS tapes, or you couldn't buy DVDs or Blu-rays. They didn't exist. And so I figured the only way to do that was to make my own. And that's when I made my first movie, when I was 9 years old, in my backyard, about a dinosaur attacking a little model railroad village. And
well, even at that age, how did you know the techniques at that young of an age?
Yeah, it was like an epiphany for me. So,
well, how did you know the techniques at that young of an age, though? Because you don't realize there's a school to teach you this until you go to college. But how did you learn how to do forced perspective?
Well, that was the thing in those days. You didn't know; you had to figure it out. And I was convinced that the dinosaur I saw in The Beast of 20,000 Fathoms, and also things like Seven Voyages of Sinbad, you know, these other things Ray Harryhausen was doing, King Kong, the Willis O'Brien film, I thought those were robots. I mean, I had no idea that there was anything called stop motion. And one day, when I was about 14 years old, I stopped to think. I said, you know, if you can make an animated cartoon by showing a bunch of drawings and taking one frame at a time, maybe you could do the same thing with a model. And so I made a model dinosaur. I did some experimenting with some kitchen utensils. I set the camera up on a tripod, and I moved some things around a frame at a time. And when I got the film back, lo and behold, the things were moving. So the next thing I did was I tried with a clay model dinosaur, and it worked. But all those effects I did, most of them I had to figure out myself. I did Invisible Man, you know, using the black hood over the head and the black background and mm-hmm. double exposing it. And I did my own lap dissolves by backwinding and fading out and fading in scenes. All the stuff you have to figure out yourself, because in those days there was no books, there were no how-to videos, there was no TV documentary showing how you did it. These were all secrets that Hollywood held, and they wanted to keep the mystery, unlike today where you, like I say, nobody says, how did they do that? You know how they did it. Somebody behind a computer. And so it was an exciting journey for me as I learned. And then I was amazed when I came out to California and started hanging around with people like Bob Burns, finding out that some of the things I was doing were the way that they actually did them in Hollywood, except, of course, they had a lot more money and a lot more talent and a lot more everything else than I had, you know. But Basically it was the same kind of techniques.
But yeah, you knew the technique. Well, that must have just been amazing when you got to USC then, and you sort of had that basis already. You were there around the same time, or at the same time, as George Lucas and John Carpenter?
And well, Carpenter came a little after me, but I was there the same time. Lucas was there, John Milius. And, you know, Randall Kleiser, who was my roommate for the first semester at the dormitory. So, there were a lot of... Those are the golden years of USC.
I was going to say, take us into that world, just that time period. I mean, obviously, you don't know at the time what's going to happen, but just what was the atmosphere like with yourself and all these other creative geniuses kind of running around?
Well, I was like almost persona non grata. They threatened to boot me out of the cinema department several times because... Not because of my ability, because I was making films better than a lot of the people that were there. It was because of my taste, my personal taste. They found out I read comic books, and to them, that was a reason for getting me out of the department. So I had to take one course over because I made a Superman film. And I said to the instructor, I said, why do I have to take this over? Why did he give me this C or a D or whatever it was? Because my film is better than most of the films. He said, yeah, and he wagged his finger at me, and he said, but you made a Superman movie. So in those days, you know, before Lucas made Star Wars and everybody started worshiping him and, you know, he started donating all the money to the school and everything, in those days, what they were pushing were these avant-garde Italian movies and documentaries and things, and they pretty much told us that none of you are ever going to get in the business. It's a closed shop. The best you can hope for is maybe making a documentary or working in a camera shop or being a projectionist in a movie theater. So what happened with me was, you know, it was kind of the hippie thing was just starting up. So there was still like, it was like that transition period between the beatnik era and the hippie era. And so I got very bitter about movies for a while. And I just played the game their way the last semester there where I had to take it over. I just did everything that they wanted. You know, there was no passion in that last semester for me. I got in the music business. And an opportunity came my way because one of my dreams since I was a teenager was to become a rock star. And so I had an opportunity. I went with that. So for years I was in the music business. And movies. I had a real late start actually getting into professional movies.
Was this the band that was produced by Michael Nesmith at that time?
Well, I played in a lot of bands in Chicago, and I played in a few bands out here in Los Angeles. But then, yeah, the biggest opportunity was the one Mike Nesmith produced, and that was the Penny Arcade.
Okay.
And we lived like rock stars for a couple of years. That was a great time, great period of my life.
Well, you can only imagine if they knew then what they know now about Hollywood and superheroes and comic book movies and TV shows. This was all going to go. You guys will never make it in this business. That's all it is now.
And superheroes, you know, when I was a kid, the only thing you had movie-wise, superheroes, you had a George Reeves Superman show, TV show. And if you knew about them and knew where to get them, you could rent, you know, like The Adventures of Captain Marvel and run them in your basement, you know, for friends. But they become mainstream. Now they're mainstream movies. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you, I never thought I would say this, but I'm really getting tired of superhero movies.
Blasphemy!
I really am. I'd like to see something like On the Waterfront again, you know. Or
those days are gone.
The Godfather.
Yeah. I think those films are still out there, but I mean, you know how Hollywood works. It's, you know, once you have success. And here's what I've always said is that you've got 3/4 of a century of history of tales and stories, parts of the, you know, ones you've written that are out there, all storyboarded, all ready to go. And so we've been, you know, us nerd culture have been saying this forever, is that you've got 3/4 of a century of stories out there just waiting to be told. Yeah, I don't think we're going to see an end to that anytime soon. You mentioned those short films you were making. It's unbelievable. 41 amateur films?
41, yeah.
Okay, for somebody that wants to know...
By that I mean 41 that have like an actual story to them.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I shot a lot of test footage and things like that. But yeah, 41 actual movies that have like a... hopefully a beginning, middle, and end.
Okay, so for our listeners who want to know more about these, there's a book, there's a DVD, a, you know, 2-disc DVD, there's a soundtrack I think you put out. I Was a Teenage Movie Maker.
Right.
All the movies are there on the DVD, like all these short films.
All of them,
okay,
yes.
These are crazy to me. I love this. These are some of the craziest crossovers. There's one that's even, what, Superman, The Spirit, Frankenstein's Monster?
Yeah.
All in the same film.
Played by Glenn Strange, no less.
Yes, by the original Frankenstein. I love Abbott Costello meet Frankenstein. I love Grant. How did you get Glenn Strange to come back for what basically is maybe one of the beginnings of fan films?
I have to thank Bob Burns for that.
Okay.
I was out here in California for a visit for the summer. I was trying to get a summer job at CBS, which never worked out. But I came out to California with the intention of making a movie called Superman at the Earth's Core. I even wrote a script for it, and it was based on Superman going to Edgar Rice Burroughs' Pellucidar. And, you know, my mother made a Superman costume.
Nice.
But getting actors to play Sagoths and Diane the Beautiful and all these things, it just was very impractical. But I wanted to do something with a Superman suit, and... So I got this idea to do The Adventures of the Spirit. At the time, I didn't know anything about the Spirit. All I knew was he wore a mask. I didn't know he didn't carry guns, you know. So it was just sort of imagining what the Spirit was like. And Bob Burns knew I was a big Frankenstein fan, as he was, and he knew I really wanted to meet Glenn Strange. So this was in July, and I got this call from Bob saying, how would you like to go to a 4th of July barbecue party at Billy Strange's house. Now, Billy Strange is not related to Glenn Strange in any way. They just have the same last name. But Billy Strange was the guy who orchestrated, did the arrangement of These Boots Are Made for Walking, the Nancy Sinatra song. And he also played the guitar on the single recording of the Munsters TV opening. You know, there was a 45 of that. And I said, sure. And he said, Glenn Strange is going to be there. I said, well, you bet I'll be there. So we went. He picked me up.
There's a barbecue and a half.
Yeah. So we got up to the house. And the first thing person I see when I look out of the window as we pulled up into the driveway was Glenn Strange. He had a big cowboy hat, smile, big mustache, you know, from the he was doing the Gunsmoke show.
Yeah.
And the first thing is, Bob said, hi, Bob. And the first thing I remember Glenn Strange saying to me was, have some beans. I cooked them myself. So we were at this party. And during the party, everybody got real chummy and friendly and everything. Everybody was having a good time. And I said to Bob, do you think Glenn would maybe do a cameo in my movie? And he said, well, we can ask him. And I said, hey, would you mind doing, I'm making this movie, would you mind doing a cameo? No problem, sure, I'd be glad to. And then I said, is it possible, and a little bell went off in the back of my head. I said, do you think you could do a cameo as a Frankenstein monster? He said, sure, no problem.
Wow.
And so we went over there to his house in Glendale to do the scene, and Bob was all prepared to do the makeup. And Glenn was all prepared to shave his mustache off to do this makeup. So Bob made up his hands with the gray grease paint. And then he's thinking, you know, we really shouldn't ask him to shave his mustache off. You know, he's doing Gunsmoke. And I was thinking, well, the makeup department could give him a fake mustache. But, you know, I had to agree with him, even though it was breaking my heart not to have Glenn to wear the mask he wore during his personal appearances when he was promoting Abbott Costello and Me Frankenstein. Right. So we did it. I have this knack for getting old actors, and of course they're all gone now, but people like Roy Barcroft and Kenny Duncan, to do little parts in my movies. Wow. You know, maybe they just liked me or they were bored. I don't know what the reason was, but they did it, and so I got some of these old familiar faces.
That's amazing. And he's battling Superman. I mean, you've got Frankenstein's monster and Superman. It's unbelievable. Yeah, these movies are out there.
An original Aurora model kit when he flies when he flies by.
Oh, I love the Spider-Man one, which I mean, you look at it today, it's almost like Robot Chicken. It's like a combination of Robot Chicken and the old 70s Spider-Man TV show. It's these are fun to watch, some of these things. Well, yeah, you just get the DVD and those things are out there. Is that the one that got you almost booted out of USC?
No,
it was another Superman.
Well, the first project I ever did at USC was Captain America versus the Mutant. And when that came on the screen, everybody was like, everybody was looking at these kind of artsy, craftsy things, you know. Then this Captain America thing came on, and nobody knew how to deal with it. And it was the same teacher I had who, the next year, gave me the assignment to that became the Superman film. And the way these assignments were given out, for instance, on the Captain America, they gave us a roll of film, 100-foot roll, 60-millimeter film, which ran about 3.5 minutes, okay? And say, okay, no editing is allowed. Just go out and shoot. We need one close-up. We need one pan shot. And we got to see an example of everything on this reel. So I wasn't going to just sit there and shoot flowers growing or whatever. So I got, and Bob Burns had just acquired this mutant head from Don Post Studios that was pulled from the same mold as the one in This Island Earth. And he had the Captain America costume from the Republic serial. So let's make Captain America versus the Mutant. And we did it, and all those requirements were made in that film.
Wow.
And I'll never forget, there was one scene where Captain America shoots the mutant with a ray gun. And the ray gun was a prop from the old Space Patrol television show. And for some reason, the film jammed just at that moment. So Kathy Burns, Bob's wife, had a blanket in the car. So we took the blanket out, and by feel, I opened the camera to rethread the film. And by doing that, a little bit of light got in. So when you watch the film, suddenly there was this, he fires a gun and this flare came up. And it looked like it was a ray gun flare. Wow. And the teacher said, how did you ever do that? And I said, well, you know, I needed a flare, so I opened the camera real just for a fraction of a second under this blanket. Oh, that's what I call, you know, really being innovative, being really creative. So I got kudos for that. But then when I made the Superman movie, which not only had Superman, it also had a gorilla played by Bob, a lot of explosions and things, and that kind of broke the camel's back. So.
Well, yeah, I mean, you talk about even Stan Lee, who, like, he wouldn't tell people that he wrote comic books because he wanted to be this, you know, write the great American novel and thing. And I guess at that time, it just, people looked down on comic books, period.
Oh, yeah,
full stop.
Yeah.
I mean,
a lot of the old Golden Age artists and writers used pseudonyms and things because mm-hmm. they didn't want people to know what they did, you know. But, you know, by the time I got into it, you were a fan, and it was something you aspire to. It was something you felt like you were part of a cool in-group or something. Mm-hmm. And so I was always very proud of what I did. You know, a lot of people say, well, gee, why do you put your name on something like this or like that? I said, well, to me, you know, if I've done it, and if I'm not going to be proud in some way, I shouldn't have done it, you know. And I let people know when something was just done for the money and when it was just, you know, and that really offends a lot of people. They want to think that, you know, you're a fan of these things and you do it out of love, but it's not really the way it is. Maybe for some people, but not for me.
Was it around this time that you were sort of like frustrated with what was going on at USC that you got into more comic book writing? I think it was initially for Warren Publishing and things like that.
Yeah, it was. It started at Warren. I had gone through my rock and roll days, and the Penny Arcade was defunct at that point. And I tried a few other things. I did a little. I did a TV commercial with Dick Clark that I lived off of for about a year or so because of the residuals. And you know, I tried various things, but I always had the secret desire that I wanted to write comic books. When I was a kid, a teenager, I used to write and draw my own comic books. And with a friend down the street, sometimes we would ink each other's stuff. And we didn't even know what inking was back then, but we just did it and colored in it with colored pencils and whatever, and mostly horror stuff. And so I always had this in the back of my mind that I'd like to write comic books. And then one day, I got a call from Forry Ackerman, who was my agent at the time, and he said, Jim Warren needs new comic book writers for Creepy and Eerie, and then later on, you know, for Vampirella. And he said, would I like to try my hand? So I did, and they liked what I turned in. And I did quite a bit of work for Warren. It's funny now, you know, I'm writing comics for the first time in like decades for the Creeps magazine. And they're basically the same kind of things I was doing for Warren. So I've kind of come full circle with the comics.
Nice. How did you create Dagar the Invincible?
It's a really long story, which I think was covered in one of the Dark Horse introductions. But Dagar, I was writing stories for Mystery Comics Digest at Gold Key. And I just introduced a sword and sorcery character at one point. It's just for a story. It wasn't intended to be any kind of a continuing character or anything. And then I decided to do another one with the same character. And once they saw two stories with the same character, they saw the possibilities of doing a series of books. Mm. And so that's how Dagar came about. And sword and sorcery characters were very popular at the time. Conan was, you know, in its early stages at Marvel. And Dr. Spectre just started out as a host character. I was looking for a new trying to come up with a new host character, and I think the name was probably, inspired by the Spectre at DC, and also Dr. Drew, the old Jerry Grandinetti character, and some of the things they were doing at Charlton. And so it just started out as a host character, and then when they decided to do a Dr. Spectre book, the story I turned in was not a host character story. It was a story where he was a character in the story, and they didn't want to do it. They didn't think anybody, you know, their idea of Dr. Spectre was just somebody like Uncle Creepy or the Vault Keeper who introduced stories, and then they grudgingly accepted it. And then, of course, later on, they said, will let you continue writing him as a character as long as in the back of the book you have a story that he narrates. And I never liked that idea because I wanted to have more pages to develop the characters a little more. And then finally, when I turned him into the werewolf character for a while, they admitted that having a guy who's on the run as a werewolf narrating stories in the back of the book didn't seem to fit. So they just, for those issues, they dropped the backup story, and we never went back to the backup story. So, those were just two characters that popped into my mind as sort of one-shots and then evolved into something bigger.
Obviously, you always wanted to deal with writing stories for comic book characters, live action. You did all these short films and everything. Your first paid gig, pretty cool, Captain Marvel on Shazam. How did you enter the world of Shazam?
Well, you know how that came about. I have a knack for being in the right place at the right time, and all these strange coincidences happening. I got a phone call from David Gerald, the science fiction writer, who was a friend of mine, and he said that he was story editor on the show called Shazam, based on Captain Marvel, and if I would like to submit a story. So I said, yeah, that'd be great. I'd love to get into television. That's where the money is. Then what happened was David, for some reason, left the show. I don't know what the reason was. If he got fired, if he quit, or whatever, I have no idea. But anyway, he had left the show. So I called up Filmation, and I said, David was going to give me a chance writing the show, and there were two new story editors to replace him, Chuck Menville and Len Jansen. And Chuck Menville was, the brother of Doug Menville, who did some books on EC Comics years and years ago. Anyway, so they said, yeah, come on down. And I met with Lou Scheimer. Lou Scheimer was the head of Filmation. He just died about a year ago.
Yeah, the late great.
And Lou was this guy. He reminded me of Sheldon Leonard, kind of talking out of the side of his mouth, kind of like a New York gangster type. And that's what he reminded me of. And he said, I'm going to give you a chance. I'm going to give you a brand new writer who's never written television a chance. And you know why? And I said, no, why? He said, well, Carmine Infantino, who was in publisher of DC Comics, and they had revived the Captain Marvel character, said, was trying to push, people that were working for DC in New York onto the show. And he didn't particularly like Carmine. And he said, Carmine had told him that, don't hire Don Glute, he's written some Captain Marvel stories for us and they were terrible. Well, the truth is, I never wrote any Captain Marvel stories or anything for DC at that point. He was just trying to get his people in. And he said, just because he said that about you, and because I don't like Carmine, I'm going to give you a chance on this.
You weren't about to correct him, were you?
No. So that's how my life has been a series of being in the right place at the right time.
Wow.
And yet it makes you wonder, if something had changed, if you were looking the other direction 5 seconds earlier. I was in England once, and I was in a hotel, a little tiny hotel in England. And I was standing there at the counter, where you check in and everything, and they had a window on the door. And for some reason, while I was waiting for the guy to come to the counter, I happened to turn my head and look out the window, and I saw a friend of mine from Pasadena, a good friend of mine, crossing the street. I mean, if I had looked 5 seconds later, 5 seconds earlier, I wouldn't have seen it. I mean, you wonder how many opportunities you miss just for little things like that happening or not happening.
Yeah, serendipity. Yeah. It just plays into it. It's actually a pretty cool episode. You only wrote one, got a chance to write one of the episodes. It's entitled The Brain.
You got
Jimmy the Brain Carter.
Yeah.
Before Jimmy the President Carter.
Yeah. But they didn't pay peanuts for that. They paid pretty well. But, then I could never
get on
the air.
You're here all week.
Yeah, the story, the guy who took over from Len and Chuck for the second season didn't particularly like me. I made the mistake of, if you ever notice at the end of that show, there's a list of child psychologists. Mm-hmm. Well, this is the days when they were really I mean, if you just frowned at somebody, that was considered violence, pretty much.
Yeah. And, like Captain Marvel can never throw a punch. There's no violence. It was all morals and lessons.
I said to him, wouldn't it be great if we could do an episode where crooks shoot at him and the bullets bounce off his chest? And he looked at me in horror, you know, when I said that. And I was never able to, you know, communicate with him again. That was the end of Shazam. I learned early on certain things that, you know, if you want to work, you don't say, you don't do, because they have their own rules, and, you know, you got to follow them if you want to work.
Well, how did you approach this particular episode? So you get the gig, and they're like, okay, we need you to write this. What knowledge did you have of the show going into it? And it doesn't follow the comic book at all. I mean, it's very, it's pretty basic.
Shazam was really not written for kids. It was written for the censors. I mean, almost all the Saturday morning stuff I did was not, almost none of it was written for kids. It was written for the Saturday morning censors. And you wrote things that you knew they were not going to put the kibosh on. Mm-hmm. And in the case of Shazam, each show has what they call a Bible. And the Bible has all the character breakdowns, how they interact, a sample of some of the storylines, you know. Then you got to come up with something new. So I just came up with a storyline that they liked, and that was The Brain. I think the original title of that was Bookworm, and I guess they didn't like that title. But they changed it to the Brain.
Yeah, because the whole thing is about him, like this character that reads books, and he like kind of lives in the fantasy world of books, and he can't relate to folks on the outside. Was that sort of just the you know, here's a group of kids and this kid has a problem and go help Captain Marvel go fix the problem? Was that basically the marching orders you got?
Yeah. And then at the end, you know, a mentor would say, he would always say, well, I better call the authorities, you know, and it put a damper on everything. But that's pretty much what it was. And then towards the end, they tagged on that that epilogue where
the morals, we always had them. That's what helped raise me as a kid.
Yeah, where Captain Marvel would come out and say, well, if you kids weren't smart enough to figure out what the very blatant message was in this show, I'm going to explain it to you now. And then it's, well, blah, 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 blah. And so I find the Shazam show embarrassing. I really do. I mean, a lot of people really loved it.
Oh, I'm one of them. Full disclosure, I'm one of them.
Well, but
I was seven. I was six, 7 years old. It helped raise me. So, yeah.
Well, maybe you were too young then to know the very blatant, obvious message. So, Captain Marvel had to explain it to you.
He did. I kind of picked it up as I went along. Well, if you hit us over the head with it, you know, Davy Crockett, be always sure you're right.
I couldn't think of anything, and I was a big Davy Crockett fan when I was a little kid.
Do you remember the quote? Do you remember the quote?
That's where that went. Yeah, be sure you're right, then go ahead.
That's right. Always be sure. Be always sure you're right, and then go ahead. So, see, you taught us lessons there. Well, look, you mentioned our friends over at the Shazam Isis podcast. You guys kind of broke this episode down a little bit. You mentioned about the one thing I thought was interesting too was that the ending you wrote, that's not the ending we see in the episode.
Yeah, the ending I wrote, they couldn't do. He was not on a conveyor belt. He was on a pier.
Yeah, so for those that haven't seen it, it's like it's an initiation. They're trying to get this kid in, and it's like, hey, walk along this conveyor belt that's like way up high, and then all of a sudden it starts up, and the kid can't get off it, and he's in danger, and Captain Marvel has to come save him.
Yeah, but the pier had to collapse, and in those days, I didn't know what things about budgets and all that. And
they so you had this entire pier collapsing, and all the kids plunge into the water to their doom.
Yeah, and Captain Marvel holding it up from, you know.
Nice.
So that was just unrealistic. And, you know, I really learned those things by making my own movies.
Yeah.
You know, things you can't do and things that you'd like to do, but you don't have a zillion dollar budget. And so you compromise in some ways, or you do them, do things in a different way. And I've gotten to be very good at that, being very ruthless on my own ideas, on my own stuff. And if we can't get a certain prop or an actor or a location or something, or you do something else. You figure something else out, and I got to be very good at that.
Yeah, and the ending, it's interesting too, because the ending they end up with is Captain Marvel has to, you know, bring the conveyor belt to a screeching halt. So I thought, you know, like you said in that interview I referenced, just swoop in and pick him up. But You couldn't have got the cool superpowered scene there.
Well, a lot of things, you know, when you're a little kid watching someone, you don't think of the logic, you know. Like,
no,
you know,
I liked him. I liked him grabbing the thing and bringing it to a screeching halt.
Yeah,
that was a cool thing. You also mentioned in that interview too, is the fact that you, I guess there, well, you referenced the one script you wanted to have like this big action sequence and all those things. And then also you referenced a Captain Marvel Shazam feature that you were planning with Jackson Boswick. Both of those didn't happen. Do you still, I know we've seen video like in your man cave, your horror cave and all that, of all your scripts that you've had bound volumes of these things.
In my what?
In your man cave, your horror cave?
What is that? Oh, I could call it my museum. But anyway.
Your museum? We all have our man caves. We all have, our nerd caves and things. Yeah. But you got all these scripts. Do you still have like those unproduced Captain Marvel scripts at all?
I have that someplace, but I have no idea where it is. It was Jackson wanted to do a Captain Marvel movie, and but do it in the C.C. Beck style. Yeah, or you know, it would have the Lieutenant Marvels. It would have Black Adam. It would have Savannah, the Rock of Eternity, and all that stuff in it. And that's what I did. I wrote a treatment on spec, and he liked it, but then he was never able to get it off. Dare I say it, off the ground. You know?
But you still have that script somewhere.
Yeah, but I wouldn't. If you put a gun to my head, I probably couldn't find it. I have no idea where that would be.
Well, I thought it was interesting.
I never throw anything away like that.
Yeah, I know. We see you keep everything. I was curious because Filmation did an animated series not long after that. I mean, you know, using the same music, but it was, you know, with Dr. Savannah and you know, Mr. Mind and all these things. Did you have any interest in getting into that, or was that just not even on your radar?
I tried getting into all those things. You
okay, because I know you did a lot of Saturday morning TV.
Saturday morning to me is a vile business. It doesn't matter how good you are. It depends who the story editor is and who his friends or her friends are. And you know, when a new story editor comes on, they bring in all their cronies, and they're the ones that get the jobs.
Okay.
And you could have written the best episodes, or you know, the previous season, the highest rating. And that Shazam episode was the highest rated episode of the season. And there were people calling me up saying, did you see the ratings on that show? Anyway, you're at the mercy of who the story editor is. If they like you, if they're friends of yours, you get on. If not, it's real difficult. And I've always had a struggle because I have never been part of that inner circle of animation writers. You know, and it's always been starting from ground zero. Every single time, making the phone calls, trying to explain, submitting sample scripts, you know, the whole thing, and when there's somebody new. And so I never got on that show. I did a couple other things for Filmation because Chuck and Len were story editing. I did an episode of The Young Sentinels. I did an episode of Tarzan, Lord of the Jungle. But those are the only things I ever able to get on at Filmation after that, and that's because they were doing the shows. And that was the case everywhere, Hanna-Barbera, Marvel, you name it.
You never should have suggested an action episode of Shazam. You probably could have stayed.
I never should have, yeah.
Dave,
and ironically, the story editor was he used to write for, like, you know, the old live-action Western shows and things, you know, Sky King, and I see his name all over the place. But somewhere along the line, he had a change of attitude, and became this goody two-shoes.
Oh, Boswick wanted to do those episodes. I mean, he's talked about that a lot of times. Even, you know, he referenced in my interview with him, he referenced, you know, he really wanted to amp that up a little bit. So, now, you know, what could have been, but one of the animated series you did get to work on, actually two of them in the Spider-Man universe, Spider-Man and Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends. How did you get involved in the world of Marvel animation, the world of Stan Lee, and the world of Spider-Man?
I'd already written some of the Marvel comic books at that time, so I had my name was sort of known, and I'd met Stan a couple times. But the Spider-Man show that continued the old Ralph Bakshi series, they needed more episodes for syndication. And somehow I found out about that. I don't know who told me, but I called a story editor up who knew very little about Marvel Comics or Spider-Man, and he was willing to give me a chance, and I wrote one, and he said, this is one of the best scripts I've ever read, and he let me do, I think, four altogether for that series. And then he called me. He said, hey, we're going to move to the network. We'll do the Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends show. And do you want to write some scripts? And I came on board for that, and I wrote a bunch of those, too. I even ghost wrote half of one of them. And then other writers came in. It's great seeing Stan Lee every day. I really like Stan. And
so you got to work directly with him then? Because this was like the first Marvel animated series. They had farmed it all out to other animation studios, but this was the first one that they were doing themselves.
And
so you got to work directly with Stan pretty often on this?
Oh yeah, he would call me up. Hey, how about a story like this or whatever, you know. Yeah, he was very cordial. He was a fun guy. He really was, you know. And it was a pleasure working with Stan. So, you know, I wrote a bunch of those, and the story, if you notice, there's like real differences between episodes that different writers wrote. Some are right on, dead on, the comic books, and some are just like typical Saturday morning shows. It could have been interchangeable with any other characters, and that's because some of us were comic book people, and some of us weren't, and the story editor didn't really know the difference. I remember when I first brought in Captain America and Sub-Mariner to some of those early Spider-Man shows, he didn't know who those characters were. He'd never heard of them. And I had to convince him that these were actually characters in the comic books.
Oh, man.
And then you got other people doing other stories that had no relationship to the comics. But we did a lot of them. I did a lot of them. I wish they'd come out on DVD, the Spider-Friend show.
Any update, like any word on that at all? Because I know at that time, and it always gets into these legal wranglings with Marvel and these projects, because they had the rights had been farmed out to like everybody. That's why, you know, you don't see the Nicholas Hammond series on DVD, and you know, it just so many companies, I'm guessing, would start, you know, laying claim to it. Is that, do you hear any rumblings on that at all? Because I know we had like VHS releases and stuff of them.
No, all I heard was, you know, basically what you just said. There's copyright issues and a lot of entanglements. I mean, look how long it took for the Adam West Batman series to come out.
50 years.
The Adventures of Superman. I heard that The Adventures of Superman with George Reeves, the main problem was the music rights.
Wow.
Whoever wrote the theme song or something was holding out, you know, after many years. There's all kinds of strange reasons why these things don't come out.
Yeah, you mentioned one of the greatest episodes, The Capture of Captain America. This is for the Spider-Man series proper, the one that was in syndication. 18 years after your Captain America Red Skull film, you're finally paid as a professional to write these two legendary characters. Did you take anything from your original fan film back in the day?
No. I was basing the Captain America story as much as I could on the stories that Jack Kirby was illustrating in the back of Tales of Suspense at that time. And there was a scene that I never forgot where the Red Skull is talking to one of his underlings, and he says something like, "Shave, your grooming is atrocious," or something like that. And I took that line and I changed it to like, "Comb your hair," or something. and that's what I was trying to do, make it like that series that was being published in Tales of Suspense at the time.
Oh.
And I was trying to make Sub-Mariner like, you know, the way he was being portrayed too, with Namor Rita and all that. But one of the episodes, I think it's the Sub-Mariner episode where the gangsters are all coming in from out of town.
Mm-hmm.
That was fun because when I looked at the artwork of those characters in the comics, you know, like Silvermane always reminded me of Boris Karloff. So in the script, I said he should sound sort of like Boris Karloff. Hammerhead or, you know, it was sort of like Flattop. It reminded me of James Cagney. So have him talk like James Cagney in the script. So I was trying to give movie actor characterization to these drawn comic characters.
Okay, so as the writer, could you put that in there and then have them respond to that, even in the voice direction and things like that?
Oh, sure, you can do anything you want in the script.
Okay, but I mean, they paid attention to that, and did it come out the way you
always
wanted it to? Okay.
Almost every time I did a dinosaur story for anybody, I would, you know, have a T-Rex come in, a Tyrannosaurus. And I say, now, Tyrannosaurus has only two claws on his hand. Every little kid in the world watching this show is going to know that the Tyrannosaurus has two claws on each hand. Then I would watch the cartoon. It's four claws in each hand, five claws in each hand, three claws. They just didn't pay any attention. You know?
I'm trying to remember. Did they get it right in The Crime of All Centuries, the Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends?
I don't think so. I don't think they ever got it right.
Okay, yeah. Shockingly enough, this may have been your first one because it was like one of the first ones that aired. It features dinosaurs.
Yeah.
That's all where, you, right?
Yeah. I got to the point where some of the story editors I worked with, they knew because of my love of dinosaurs. They would save the dinosaur episodes for me. And that's how I got to write all those Transformers episodes with the Dinobots.
Okay, that's why I was curious, because you mentioned Stan would mention things to you. So were you given direction as to the type of story they were looking for, or did you get to just go in and do your own original thing, or is it a combination of both?
I just did my own original thing on the Spider-Man show.
Okay.
I know with things like the Transformers and G.I. Joe, those were half-hour commercials, let's face it, that's what those were.
They weren't aimed
to entertain, they were aimed to sell toys.
Right.
And they would tell me what toy they were promoting on that episode. And with the G.I. Joe thing, it was tough because they wanted me to promote this character who was like a skier or something, you know, on ice and snow. And the episode was set in a desert in Mongolia or someplace. And I had to figure out some way of shoehorning him into the story.
Because they needed a toy?
Yeah, they just, toy promoters are not story people. They don't understand about logic and plots and things like that. So, I was... I had pretty much free rein on the Marvel stuff I did.
Okay, and some of these even in-jokes, too. I'm wondering, like, the comic book research you did in that episode, The Crime of All Centuries, which features Kraven the Hunter and a T-Rex. You always get a T-Rex. I thought it was cool, too, that you had Ms. Lion, the little dog, go toe-to-toe with a T-Rex.
Oh, I hated that character. Everybody hated that character, except...
You almost squashed her! The foot was coming. You almost, like... You almost got
it. I wish there was an outtake of it. You know, that was so embarrassing because that show was basically for little boys, you know. Yeah. And every time that Ms. Lion comes on with that bow and everything, and the story editor loved that character. He came up with that character. And when he would be talking story, telling you a plot or something, he would say, and then Ms. Lion, and he would go into this whole dramatic thing, and it was just painful. And we had to put Ms. Lion in every episode doing something sort of more or less significant, you know, and it was so, I just hated that character.
Yeah, she squares off against a T-Rex, though. Oh, it was interesting in that, the very beginning, it opens in a dinosaur movie, Dinosaur Destroyer, and on the marquee, it says starring Simon Williams and Karen Page. Did you put that in? Because I know those are two Marvel characters, Simon
Williams.
Yeah,
Dinosaur Destroyer was the name of one of my amateur movies I made when I was a kid.
So they're seeing, okay, so that's the movie that they're seeing, and then you put the Marvel names in, too, on the marquee.
Yeah, yeah.
That's fantastic.
I had Bruce Wayne in one story. The one where Iron Man makes the appearance, you know, where he's financing their room.
The one I wanted to ask you about, because that, I talked about that on a couple times on this episode, because everyone always wonders, like, how the Spider-Friends can't pay rent, but they can afford all this high-tech equipment. Did you come up with the idea to have Tony Stark fund them, or did that somebody say, here's the...
No,
well,
that was totally me, because it bothered me, too. I couldn't figure out why. How do they install it without Aunt May snooping around, you know?
Yes.
But I had a scene where they're talking about various millionaires or something. They mentioned... I don't think I said Bruce Wayne, but it was obviously Bruce Wayne. I think I said the name Wayne, Mr. Wayne, a multi-billionaire or something like that.
Oh, nice.
And they did catch that, so that was cut out.
So they caught that in the script and took it out before you even got there.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now that's I love that you put that in there, or put the idea in the Tony Stark fund, because that was always, even as a kid, I remember watching, like, how could they, like, they can't come up with $50 for rent, but they can. And then you know, there you go. Now, did Stan or somebody come to you and say, hey, look, we're getting... Because even in the episode, it's referenced, Stan does the narration. He's like, oh, we're getting lots of letters wondering how they can afford all this.
Yeah, I think I wrote Stan's dialogue for all those things.
So they came to you, so Stan, did Stan come to you and say, hey, we need an episode that explains all this?
No, it was just something I picked out of the air.
Okay. Cool. Well, that certainly worked out. And then you got a couple of the three of the four origin episodes. that came out of this too. Did
I
you?
Did.
What did you do to kind of put those in? Can you give us some behind the scenes on that?
Well, yeah. The Spider-Man origin was in a way that cost me a lot of work because the network wanted an origin for Spider-Man, and Stan said Don's the one to write it. You know, because I had the comic book credentials and all that sort of thing. And so he wanted me to write it personally, hand-picked me. But because of the censorship thing, you know, the whole idea of Spider-Man being Spider-Man, you know, with great responsibility and all that, is Uncle Ben has to die. It's just like Bruce Wayne's parents have to die for him to become Batman. And, of course, you can't have anybody die on Saturday morning cartoons, and you certainly can't have them get shot. So Stan said, okay, unless Uncle Ben dies, you're not going to do the origin. And he kept going back and forth, back and forth. Meanwhile, I'm on hold to write this script. And in the meanwhile, the Hulk show starts up, and I'm trying to get on the Hulk show, and the story editor says to me, oh, you can't, as soon as we get the go-ahead, the okay on the Spider-Man origin story, you're going to do it. We can't have you tied up with anything else. So basically all the story assignments for the Hulk got given out to other people. Well, I'm sitting there twiddling my thumbs, waiting for the network to figure out some way of agreeing to Stan's demand. So finally, I said, we got the go-ahead, but I couldn't show a gun. I couldn't mention he was dead or any of this sort of thing. So I wrote the script based directly on the, the amazing fantasy story. On those panels, filling in the blanks, so it wouldn't. If I just used those panels, it would have been a very short story. Mm-hmm. So it would be like, you know, Peter Parker comes home and a cop says, I got bad news for you. Your uncle, is he? Yes. But he never said dead. And when you see the burglar, he puts his hand under his coat, under his jacket, but he doesn't pull a gun out. So you kind of know, well, what's he doing? Has he got an itch? Is he scratching himself? Is he trying to be Napoleon or something? But you never see the gun. So we finally did it. And but it cost me a lot of work sitting around waiting to get the okay on that story.
Wow. Yeah, because I think they only produced a couple of episodes that season, even for Spider-Man's Amazing Friends. So, yeah, it wasn't even like I think it was like three episodes produced that entire season.
Yeah. One of the episodes I saw on, I was watching a Chuck Norris movie called Missing in Action, and he gets the idea for the rest of the story in his movie because he's watching a Spider-Man and his Amazing Friends cartoon. The one with the shocker was the one that inspires the Chuck Norris character to go back to Vietnam or whatever, wherever it was, and rescue his friends. Now, here's another behind-the-scenes thing. The Writers Guild of America, which I'm a member of, doesn't recognize animation writing as writing, okay? Even though you're writing scripts, in a sense, even directing scripts, because you're directing them on paper, but they don't recognize those as scripts. So I saw this on television, the Chuck Norris movie, and suddenly my lines that are being spoken on a cartoon are incorporated into a live-action movie. Mm-hmm. So I thought, ho-ho, maybe if I call the Writers Guild, I can get paid for this now because I'll get some extra money for this because it's no longer just a cartoon. It's part of a live-action movie, and they basically go, no, it's a cartoon. That's not writing. So anyway, that's a little
okay.
Aside.
Well, that's the first thing I think of when you say that, because I've seen that bit of trivia too, and it's like that. My first thought was, do you get residuals for the Chuck Norris movie?
Yeah, nope, not a penny.
Nothing. Oh man, Hollywood, unbelievable.
You don't get residuals for the cartoons either, unless it's like a very special show like The Simpsons. But I am getting royalties and things on, you know, things I did 30, 40 years ago. It's very strange, you know, when they come out in different formats, like DVDs and Blu-rays.
Different releases, yeah, there's all kinds of things. Well, I mean, we talk about your resume just goes on and on and on forever. Do you have a favorite series that you worked on or a favorite story that you were like, yes, I got to tell this one?
Well, okay, most of the animation, here's where I lose a lot of fans and friends. Most of the animation.
You're in a safe place. It's all good. You're fine here.
Yeah, okay. Most of the animation stuff I did is is not good. It's not very good. Let's put it, some of it's absolute crap. I'll say that. And it's just, it was just cranked out stuff for the money. You know, I learned the formulas. They're all formula shows. I learned very early on that if you do anything that's really original, and the story editor will say, "Boy, this is the best script I ever read. I never read a script like this before," you're not going to get another one, because they don't want they aim to the lowest common denominator. All the shows are cookie cutter; they're all the same. Okay, and I learned this when I was working on the Blue Falcon and
Dynamite. Yeah.
Yeah. And I had the characters go back to their cave. It's, you can't have them go back to their cave. I said, why not? Because they can't. That's part of the formula. That's part of this format. Once they leave the cave, they can never go back in the same episode. I said, well, I don't know why, but okay. And I was going to make a point. What was the original question again?
I'm just curious if you had a favorite story or episode of things you told, even live action. Doesn't necessarily have to be animation.
Okay. I didn't do a whole lot of live action on TV. I kind of like the Land of the Lost episode I did, but
Blackout.
As far as
why didn't you do more of those?
I just couldn't get on. Maybe they didn't like it, or maybe there was. I think there was might have been a was. There might have been a third season, I think, of that.
Uh-huh.
Or maybe a different story editor came on.
Yeah, yours was the finale of the second season, and then it was like the dad got off the show the next season, the uncle came in, so they switched things up.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, I was curious, because anyway, that seemed to be like right in your wheelhouse.
Yeah. There's only a handful of TV animation episodes I really put any pride in. One is the DuckTales I did, The Duck and the Iron Mask. Whenever I can't think of a story, I go back to The Man in the Iron Mask. I've done that at least three times already, The Man in the Iron Mask. But, okay, I did a RoboCop that I really liked called Rumble in Old Detroit, and they gave me free rein on it. I got to make up a street language, a futuristic street language, and the characters were more like real characters. There's a couple episodes of the Spider-Man first show. I really liked, you know, the Captain America story. Mm-hmm. I really liked the Submariner story. I have certain, you know, fondness for some of the Spider Friends episodes. The Black Knight episode, I like that. Not too much else, though. There's one or two most of the Transformers stuff was just like hacked out commercials, you know. But I liked the two-parters I did. I liked Dinobot Island, and I liked Megatron's Master Plan, because they gave me two things. They gave you an opportunity to develop the characters more, a little bit more with subplots and things like that, because you had more space, and also because you got paid twice, because you're writing two episodes for one story, and you didn't have to come up with a whole new plot, you know. So those are the things. I liked Autobot Spike. Or the Frankenstein episode. But most of the other stuff.
See, you like a lot of stuff. The more you think about it, the more you like. See, isn't that nostalgia wave just kicking in? And we love it all, too.
Yeah, but the trouble is, the more I think of a lot of it, the less I like, you know, on some of those.
We love it because we were kids and we were raised on it, and we love it.
But so much of the animation, the TV animation, is so heartbreaking, because you put a lot into a script, and then the animation is so lousy. You know, and
I thought on the Spider-Man ones, I thought especially the syndicated one, the ones that stuck closer to the comics, not necessarily the Amazing Friends,
but
I thought that one, I thought the animation was really, especially that Captain America episode and Red Skull.
I thought that looked really good. My intent always on the Marvel shows was to make them as close to the comic books as I could without violating any of the rules of the format, you know. Mm-hmm. Because I figured the people watching those things would be people who are reading the comic books and would know who Spider-Man is. And that's what they'd want to see. They wouldn't want to see some, like all these DC character shows now. I mean, they bear no resemblance to the characters. I'm figuring, you know, who's watching? I mean, one of the great things about the old George Reeves Superman series was it was like the comic books. You have, you know, he worked for the Daily Planet, he wore glasses, you know, he had Jimmy Olsen, Lois Lane, and Perry White, and the dynamics between the characters were the same. The costume looked the same. It wasn't everybody wearing black leather. Like, I mean, even the Flash and Supergirl's costumes are so dark, you might as well, they look like you went to an oil slick or something, you know?
Your age is showing now. You're going to yell at kids getting off your lawn here pretty soon.
Maybe I have to do that. But
look, they're all good dust, but I tell you what, the building blocks, the foundation, those are the things that you wrote and your peers, those are the things that we enjoyed coming up. And what I always love is that those are the projects that kept these characters front and center, whether it was Shazam, even if it was cheesy, whether it was, you know, Spider-Man, His Amazing Friends, and Ms. Lion Run Around. It kept the characters in a animated or live-action format in front of everybody. So you laid the building blocks. You were part of laying the building blocks.
And I'll tell you, it's even the shows I dislike the most, it's still, you know, people say, how can you write that stuff? Well, to me, it's still writing, and I love writing. And what's the alternative? I could be writing a stupid Ms. Lion episode of Spider-Man and get paid a lot of money for it, or I could be working at the Ralph supermarket, you know, checking out bags all day long, you know, 5 days a week, 8 hours a day. It's still better than the alternative, no matter how you look at it, in my opinion.
We're glad you wrote Ms. Lion versus a T-Rex. I get a look. If for nothing else, you got that scene in there, and that's pretty amazing.
I don't remember that scene, but I'll take your word for
it. It's pretty awesome, but you almost squashed her. You came so close, but Spider-Man saved her at the last minute. You mentioned stuff you're working on now. You mentioned a Frankenstein.
A Frankenstein movie.
Yes.
Yeah.
So you're doing feature?
2008.
Yeah.
Yeah, 2018 will be the 200th anniversary of Mary Shelley's novel, Frankenstein. And a lot of the studios are going to be doing Frankenstein stuff, but they're mostly, I'd be willing to bet you money, they're going to be CGI fest. They're going to look like Marvel superhero movies, you know. Mm-hmm. And mine is very traditional. This is my eighth movie. It's called Tales of Frankenstein. It's based on four stories that have been, short stories of mine, that have been published in a book called Tales of Frankenstein. And each one takes place in a different country in a different time period. So we start out in Bavaria in 1899, and it just keeps going. And I got some really, really good and well-known actors in it. I've got some great sets. The monster makeups were done by John Goodwin, who's the Emmy Award winner from the CSI shows. It doesn't look like a cheesy B movie like a lot of my old movies did. This is it looks like a real movie, you know. And it's I'm really happy with this. I've got actors that you would know. We just finished shooting 2 weeks ago.
Oh wow! So this is in the can, and you're in post production now.
Yeah, we just started editing.
Okay.
And then we got to go through. We got a whole year of post production, but as I said, I don't want it to be out until 2018.
Yeah.
Because I want to take advantage of that anniversary year, the 200th anniversary of Mary Shelley's book, and mine is very traditional. You know, I've got one scene actually with villagers with torches, real torches, not phony CGI torches.
Nice.
You know?
So you're going old school with this one. I mean, you got sets, big giant sets, and some things you're working on here?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. We got coffins and laboratories
nice.
And machinery, and, you know, each story is dramatically different from the and there's like no two stories alike. So it's like a different type of situation in each one. Each story, each of the four stories has its own cast of actors, cast of characters. So there's a lot of people. I mean, there's a big cast in this movie, lot of people. And each one is done in a different style. The last one we shot is like a Hammer film. So we've got, you know, the lush colors and the sexy barmaids, you know, and all that. And the assistant named Carl. If you look at any of those, almost every one of those Hammer Frankenstein movies, Victor Frankenstein's assistant is always named Carl. And the towns are always Carlsberg and Carlsbad. He had some kind of a fetish or something, the writer of those movies or the producer, for that name Carl. So I called my guy Carl.
Probably had a relative named Carl. He just had to owe some money to or something. Yeah,
maybe.
Well,
I don't know.
I've heard you mention before, like you mentioned your movies. I mean, what's the biggest budget you've worked with before? Did I read somewhere it was like $250,000 or something?
You hit the nail on the head. The biggest one was Dinosaur Valley Girls, and that was about $250,000, $260,000. But that was shot on film, too.
Lean and Mean, if I gave you, if I were a studio, if I were Marvel or if I were Warner Brothers, and I gave you not 250,000, I gave you 250 million, what comic book story would you want to tell?
I probably would pocket the money and take a trip to...
that is not an option. You cannot embezzle those funds.
I don't know. I mean, everything's been done, really. I mean, you know, I don't know who's left, really, to do that, that's well-known enough to do anything like that, you know. But for $250 million, I can make a really good movie for about $150,000. So I would make a lot of movies. I wouldn't make just one movie.
I'm just curious if there's a story you're itching to tell that if somebody just handed you $250 million, if you'd be like, yeah, I'm going to go. This is what I want.
I don't know. I have no idea. Like everything that I ever wanted to do, you know, like 20 years ago, King Kong, and all, it's all been done.
Yeah.
All these superhero movies. I mean, who's left? You know, Bouncing Boy or
Elongated Man. There you go. You
know, or the Captain Marvel who splits. You know, remember him?
I don't know if I know that one.
Yeah, it came out in the 60s. He was a split, and his arms and his head and his legs would fly off and beat up bad guys, and then come back together. Really grotesque.
Okay. But, well, maybe there's some obscure comic book character out there that you would love to tear into. It'd be fun. Hey, how can people find out the latest and greatest in the world of Donald F. Glut, and especially when this Frankenstein movie is going to be coming out? Are they website, social media?
Yeah, I am very easy to track down. I don't know how you did it, but you did. I'm on Facebook.
We're Facebook friends. I just sent you a message.
Yeah, and I have also a fan page on Facebook.
Yeah.
And I'm really good at, I've been accused of being a shameless self-promoter, I accept that with pride. So if I'm doing something, I promote it on Facebook, but without revealing too much. Like we have two monsters in the. I've been putting a lot of photos from the Frankenstein movie on Facebook, but there's two monsters in it. I have not put photos on because I want to have some surprises. So I put it up there to, whet people's appetites.
Oh, so you got another crazy crossover coming up?
Oh no, the Frankenstein type monsters. Because remember, as I said, each story has its own set of characters, they're all connected. So like one story will be there's a painting. There's a frame story, to these four stories, where the Frankenstein monster is going through the ruins of a castle or someplace, and he's going through finds a microscope and all pieces of machinery, and then he pulls out this portrait, and it's a portrait of Victor Frankenstein that was done by my artist friend, Pete Von Schally, and this portrait turns up in every one of the four stories in one way or another.
Oh, wow.
And, so one story will be like a descendant of Victor Frankenstein. Another story will be about a guy following in his footsteps, that kind of thing. So they're all tied together by this portrait and the Frankenstein theme. And two of them have monsters in them that I have not released any photos yet because I want to have some, save some surprises.
Okay, so this they kind of weave the stories weave through. It's kind of like an anthology thing, like maybe like Creepshow or something.
Amicus movies like Dr. Terror's House of Horrors and those things. Tales from the Crypt. It's like that.
Oh, man, you've got a stoke then for this. Is it donaldfglut.com?
Yeah, that's my official website.
We're going to check that out as well. And upcoming appearances? I know you pop up at conventions every now and again.
Well, let's see. I just did the paperback show last Sunday, and the week before that I did the San Fernando Valley Comic Book Convention. Coming up, I'm supposed to do a convention in January in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and possibly one shortly after that somewhere in Ohio. I'm not sure where in Ohio, but...
Columbus would be awesome, because that's where I am.
Those are the only things that are definite right now, I don't get invited to a lot of conventions. I don't know why, but they had a Star Wars convention some years ago within walking distance of my house, and they never invited me to it. So, it's crazy. When they invite me, then we talk about it. But I don't get invited to Monsterpalooza down the street from me again. I have no idea what goes through people's minds, why they invite certain people, why they don't.
Well, we will follow you on social media. Man, I'm telling you what, thank you so much.
You'll be stalkers.
We will be cyber stalkers. We'll be nerd stalkers. That's exactly what we'll be. I tell you, thank you so much for putting the comic book and monster loving kid in you into those scripts, into the comics that you've written over the years. We love them. And thank you so much for joining me on the show today.
Well, thank you. Appreciate it.
Okay, I was not familiar with the Captain Marvel character that Donald referenced near the end of that conversation. I know Captain Marvel from Shazam. I know Captain Marvel from Marvel Comics. I know that one. Didn't know the one that splits off his body parts into different directions, though. And because we are not living in the 1960s, I was able to Google this now and find out what in the world this crazy Captain Marvel is all about. I'm telling you, that was a deep comic book cut that he presented to us. Check this out. It's Captain Marvel from MF Enterprises. That's from Pulp Magazine entrepreneur Myron Fass. It was a 4-issue comic book series featuring a crime-fighting alien android who could detach his head, limbs, and hands and send him flying off in all directions whenever he shouted, "Split!" and then reattached them when he shouted, "Zam!" Zam, that sounds a little familiar. The Captain Marvel comic book series lasted 4 issues, April to November 1966, they were cover dated, followed by 2 issues of Captain Marvel Presents the Terrible Five. The series also featured characters, catch this, named Billy Baxton, sounds familiar, Professor Doom, also Plastic Man and Dr. Fate, not the ones from DC Comics, and The Bat, which, as you would expect, eventually drew the attention of DC Comics attorney. So they changed it to The Ray, and they put a lightning bolt emblem on his chest. That sounds very familiar, too. Okay, 2 things about all this. First, I got to get a hold of these books. They sound too crazy not to have. I've been looking at the covers online, and some people have posted some of the pages. It looks very cool. 2, I'm going to guess you'd never get past the copyright infringement laws to put together a movie about this particular Captain Marvel. So, look, I mean, the dude's origin even says that he was rocketed to Earth from a dying planet. Does that sound familiar? So, probably no $250 million adaptation anytime soon on that one. But we are looking forward to the new Frankenstein flick from Donald and Company. How cool did that sound? That sounds way cool. And honestly, how often do we get to talk about a 200-year anniversary on Comic Book Central about some of the things we talked about? I think 75 is the most we've talked about, maybe 80. 200, that's pretty cool. Frankenstein, all those. Look, I'm going to have a chat with my buddy Derek over on Monster Kid Radio about this flick coming up. I think this is definitely going to be in his wheelhouse too, so that's going to be a cool one. Big thanks to Donald for stopping by today. Be sure to keep up with him online at his website and his Facebook page. I'm going to put links to both of those in the show notes for this episode at my website, comicbookcentral.net. As I mentioned earlier in the show, that feature article in Columbus Live magazine, I'm going to put a link to that in the show notes as well. Now, we chatted a bit about the Shazam television series today, as well as Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends. If you haven't heard my past episodes themed around both of those shows, by all means, check them out in the archive. Also at the website, comicbookcentral.net. Both Captain Marvels, Jackson Bostwick and John Davey, Billy Batson actor Michael Gray, he was here. Also, this was cool, my Comic Book Central commentary on an episode of Shazam with Michael Gray and John Davey. That was amazing. Plus, from Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends, the web-slinger himself, Dan Gilvezan, and Firestar Kathy Garver. They've all been here. All those cool conversations, they're there on the website. Just click the episodes tab to access the archive. Everything's in there. There's an episode guide in the about section on the Facebook page. On the website, you're also going to find a link to subscribe to the show on iTunes, so you get all those episodes there. Links to Comic Book Central on Facebook and Twitter are there as well. So everything's there for you. Go check it out. You can also click the Signal Me tab on the website to send me an email, or you can just drop me a line, joe@comicbookcentral.net. That is what Scott Doran did this week. Scott writes, "Hey Joe, regarding your second episode with Michael Uslan, I went back and listened to part one from 2014 first because I can't do a part two without a part one. I thought it was fantastic. I wish that Uslan would oversee the DC universe and not just Batman, but
that I know Jeff Johns does a great job. Anyway, looking forward to hearing some Filmation stories next. Hey, thanks for writing in, Scott. Glad you enjoyed both of those conversations with Michael Uslan. Man, I'm telling you, it's always cool to sit down with someone who not only brings comic books to life, but is a fan as well. He is definitely a fanboy, and Michael knows his stuff. If you haven't checked out his comic book crossover stories from Dynamite Entertainment, I'm telling you, go get them. The trade paperback for Lone Ranger Green Hornet is just days away from a release. I've got the original issues. It's a really fun adventure. And I hope you enjoyed the Shazam talk today. There's your Filmation episode right there. Obviously, Shazam, one of my favorite Filmation projects. If you haven't already, you're going to definitely want to check out the podcast I referred to earlier in the conversation, the Shazam Isis podcast. It's hosted by John Drew and Richard Lee. Very cool. They've got great guests, breakdown of each episode over there. Good stuff. So check that out if you want more Filmation goodness. And, man, even more Filmation. If you want more Filmation, you know you're in the right place because I'm always talking about it here. Right now, I'm in the midst of scheduling an interview that is definitely set in the wild, wonderful world of Filmation. It's going to be a good one. So as always, stay tuned to Comic Book Central. When I'm ready to announce that, you're going to know about it. All right, kids, I am staring down at a few soggy pieces of Cap'n Crunch swimming around in some pink milk, so it must be time to wrap things up. But fear not, true believers, I won't be gone for long. The next episode of Comic Book Central is right around the corner. In fact, we are about to run full speed ahead into a bunch of sci-fi themed episodes. If you love sci-fi, man, you're going to love what's coming up. I'm punching the buttons. I'm hitting the thrusters. I'm working on some crazy cool conversations for you listeners. As it stands right now, it looks like I might be going where no one has gone before for the next episode. And that's before I find myself getting lost for some other episodes. Those are your clues. That's all you're going to get right now. I got to see how things play out over the next few days. Going to check some schedules, working on some things, working on recording some conversations. Got to see where they land. Watch the Facebook page. Follow the show on Twitter. I'm going to announce the next guest on those pages. Until next week, go out and create something awesome. Keep reading those comics. And thanks for joining me here in the Lair. Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. This podcast is intended for entertainment and education purposes only. All original content in this podcast is the intellectual property of Comic Book Central and is licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivations 3.0 imported license. All the content and names are registered trademarks and copyrights of their respective holders.
Spider-Friends! Go for it! Let's visit a maximum security prison. It's the Shocker! He's making a break!
Spider-Man put me in that hole, Barcroft, and now I'm going to get even.
You may recall, himself masterminded an escape of Americans from a Vietnamese prison camp and has maintained that the camp in which he was held was not the only one in Vietnam. Though he has never been able to offer any proof of his allegations, Braddock has been known as one of the most outspoken proponents of the theory that American prisoners are still being held in Vietnam today. Braddock has, however, refused all recent offers to speak to servicemen's organizations on the subject of MIAs and has completely withdrawn from any public discussion of the MIA controversy. The American delegation had hoped that Braddock's presence at the talks would increase their ability to negotiate.
This is Braddock.